Barry Babcock is a local historian. Barry lives over in the LaPorte area, and he joins us from time to time to talk with us about topics in Minnesota's history. Today, Barry, we're going to visit with you about the Dakota War of 1862. It was a tragic event for all sides, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So what
the Dakota uprising, which is often referred to now by some historians as Minnesota's Civil War, but when I learned in school, a lot more has come to light to give the Indian side of the story, and I guess maybe that's what I'm kind of going to lean towards here. The Dakota that were left in the state then were referred to as the Santees or the Woodland Sioux, or which we now refer to appropriately as the Dakota. And originally, they had occupied the entire state. With the arrival of the Ojibwe in the 1600s, they were pushed into the southern half of the state. A treaty was negotiated by the whites to stop the warring between these two Native American nations, and a corridor, a line was set up that roughly coincides with the I-94 corridor now, so the Dakota had been squeezed into roughly the southern half of the state. Then the Treaty of 1851 had further restricted their land base to about a 150-mile corridor along the Minnesota River, running from the town just east, or excuse me, just west of New Ulm to Big Stone on the South Dakota border. This corridor along the Minnesota River originally was 20 miles wide. It was a 10-mile strip on both the north and south side of the river. This was the Treaty of 1851 that had negotiated that. Then a subsequent treaty in 1858 had further restricted the size of this reservation by removing the 10-mile corridor on the north side of the river, which was considered to be the best hunting grounds. Also, which added to the problems, was besides the Dakota giving up 9/10 of their land, and what they received for this land that they had given up, which was basically the southern half of the state, was $475,000. Henry Sibley, who's an icon in Minnesota, our second governor, was at the time as chief trader for the American Fur Company with the Dakota, had put in a claim of $145,000 against this $475,000 payment for the Dakota land as overdue payments to this, from the Santee in his fur trading business. The Dakota disputed that, said that this was not so, that they didn't owe him this much money, but Alexander Ramsey, the first governor, who was a close personal friend of Sibley's, in fact, they had even lived together for a while, had accepted Sibley's claim along with the claim of other smaller traders. So aside from receiving $475,000 for this land, much of this money, nearly half of it, was taken by traders. The Dakota numbers at that time in the state were a population was about 6,000, and at that same time, about 150,000 white settlers had sunk stakes into what was then Dakota land, or had been Dakota land. What had exacerbated the tension between the Indians and the Minnesotans were three things primarily. It was the trader debts, or a credit system that was based upon the trading system. And the traders said that the Indians had owed them money, more money than the Indians claimed they did. And when the annuity payments from the federal government, the money due to the Indians along with the food allotments, wasn't distributed directly to the Indians, it was given to these traders to distribute it. So they, at the end of the day, the traders ruled the annuity system, and they dipped into this money and removed it through a system of graft before the Indians got it. Also, the Indians were encouraged to farm. Some did and some didn't. And those that didn't take up farming were denied their annuities and their food allotments. So there was a great deal of resentment by the Dakota against farmers, whether they were white or Indian. And the third contributing factor to the tension between the whites and the Indians was the Civil War was going on then. And by 1862, things were going very badly for the Union. And the Union had just witnessed a devastating defeat, the Second Battle of Manassas or Bull Run. And the nation was being taxed heavily to finance this war, and the treasury was cash-strapped. So the Indians were the first ones to feel the brunt of this by annuities being late or withheld. And all of this started to build into a situation whereby on August 4th, 1862, angry Indians came into the Redwood Falls Trading Post on Minnesota River and demanded their annuity payments and food allotments. The trader at the time called in a Timothy Sheehan, Lieutenant Timothy Sheehan, the United States Army, and in an unusual act of sympathy, when the Indians broke into a food warehouse, Sheehan just sat back and allowed them to take the food, recognized the starvation, the hunger that was rampant amongst the Dakota. There was a trader there at that time, in a subsequent meeting, when asked about the annuities and food allotments, this was at Redwood Falls, this trader's name was Andrew Myrick. He said, "Let them eat the grass of their own dung." And there was a number of Indians at this meeting, and they all in unison got up and left. The chief of the Dakota during this time was an Indian by the name of Little Crow, highly respected by all the members of the four bands of the Santee Sioux. And Little Crow had crippled hands. His hands were usable, but he was always noted for wearing long sleeve to cover his hands. A white doctor, after a battle wound, had urged that they be amputated, and he withheld and went to a native healer and regained the use of his hands, but they were kind of crippled and deformed looking. He had urged the Indians to adopt the white way and even took up white religion. And on August 17th, when leaving church services at an Episcopal church at Redwood Falls, shook hands with all the churchgoers then, whites, mixed bloods, and Indians, and went home that day on August 17th. On August 17th, that same day, five white settlers were killed near Acton, Minnesota, in Meeker County. This kind of signaled the beginning of the war. It was kind of a chance encounter. And on August 18th, a general attack took place on Redwood Falls. This Andrew Myrick, who had made the remark about the Indians, let the Indians eat grass, his body was found there, and his mouth was stuffed with grass. Minister then, who was leaving with some white settlers who had escaped the massacre after crossing the Minnesota River, ran into a Captain John Marsh and 45 militiamen, volunteers from Fort Ridgely, who had gotten news of the attack. And Reverend, I believe his name was Hinneman, had urged Marsh to turn around, that they'd all be killed. Marsh didn't, and when they were fording the Minnesota River, an ambush took place where 28 of his men were killed out of 45. And the attack becoming general, then the Indians knew that it would be important for them to take Fort Ridgely, which was just upstream from New Ulm on the north side of the river, and that they would also have to take the town of New Ulm in order to make their uprising victorious. Two attacks took place on both Fort Ridgely and New Ulm. The attacks on Fort Ridgely were beat off mainly from the fact that the buildings there were made of stone and that the militia had cannons. The second attack on New Ulm, there was a number of settlers were killed and most of the town burnt, but the settlers were successful in driving off the Dakota. The next main battle that took place was called Birch Coulee, which was north of Redwood Falls, south of Redwood Falls, and a small contingent of soldiers from Fort Ridgely came out to bury many of the dead from the original attack on Redwood Falls, and they subsequently were attacked, and the Indians won another battle there. But by this time, the Union Army had sent members of the 3rd, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th regiments to Minnesota to quell the uprising. These were battle-seasoned veterans of the Civil War who had seen a lot of terrible fighting in the Western theater of the Civil War. Many of the names of some of the colonels and generals of this are written in our history of Minnesota's history of the Civil War. But anyhow, after these seasoned veterans had arrived, they were out to quell this uprising, and they were out west of Redwood Falls and camped overnight. In the morning, I believe it was members of the 3rd Regiment had got up and were going to be going by foot and wagon into a small trading post where they knew there was a garden and some potatoes. And here they had come upon a contingent of Indians were set up for an ambush attack that morning, and the battle began. This marked the end of the Dakota uprising, as the seasoned veterans were just too much for the smaller contingent of Native Americans, and it dragged on for some years after that. But basically, that in early September of 1862 marked the fighting of the Dakota Uprising or Minnesota Civil War. There was horrendous stories of atrocities committed on both sides. Many of the 500-plus whites that were killed were settlers, Germans and Scandinavians, who didn't know what they were getting into when they were encouraged to, upon arriving in America from the Old World, to settle here in southern Minnesota. Most of them were innocent victims. It was mainly this system of graft which initiated the fighting. Nobody knows how many Native Americans were killed. It was in excess of the whites. The Indians and mixed bloods had saved hundreds of lives of whites during this uprising. After the battle was, the fighting was over, the Native Americans surrendered. They were told that only those that had murdered non-combatants during the war would be tried or executed. So they surrendered. There was 1,600 of them that were marched downriver to Fort Snelling. Many atrocities that were committed to the Indians on this march. There's one instance of Lieutenant Colonel William Marshall, who was in the town of New Ulm. Some Indians were going to shoot, some whites were going to shoot an Indian with the white name of Charles Crawford, and Marshall ran in between them, jeopardizing his own life, and with his sword knocked the muskets out of their hands, saving the life of Charles Crawford, who later turned out, during testimony, had saved the lives of many whites. The whites reneged on their guarantee about only the non-combatants being executed. A hasty trial without proper defense for the Indians was held, and 303 were sentenced to hang in New Ulm. And to President Lincoln's credit, he went through the names of all 303 and commuted the executions down to just 38, which became the largest mass execution ever held in the United States. A lot of the credit goes to saving these Indians. These 303 was the Episcopalian bishop, Bishop Henry Whipple. And a little side note to this story is that witnessing this hanging was a 15-year-old Minnesotan by the name of Alfred Wilson, who immediately afterwards enlisted in the Civil War. Alfred Wilson became the longest surviving Civil War veteran. He died in 1956 at 109 years old. I was alive then. I can remember when he died. He was living in Duluth at this time, and there's a monument in Gettysburg to commemorate Alfred Wilson. But the mass hanging took place on December 26, 1862, and it's one of those instances where, as one Indian said, by the name of Yellow Wolf of the Nez Perce, he said, "The whites told only one side, told it to please themselves, told much that is not true, only his own best deeds, only the worst deeds of the Indians, as the white man told." And I think my time's probably running up, Scott. It's about 8:30, so maybe I've given you a good synopsis of a superficial explanation of what happened during the Minnesota's Civil War of 1862 with the Dakota, Santee, Woodland, Sioux.
Barry, as an update, and maybe it isn't quite a precise update, but just last month there was a protest, maybe earlier this month, at Fort Snelling. Did you follow the events of that, about the Fort Snelling and being celebrated, of course, as an icon of Minnesota history, the first settlement of the U.S. government in Minnesota? And there was a protest about because to draw attention to the role of Fort Snelling in the suppression of the Dakota, specifically as kind of the home base of the U.S. Army in suppression of the Dakota, not only in that war, but and previously. Were you able to follow that story?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't, no. But okay. I do know that from after the Dakota Uprising, all the Woodland Dakota were driven from the state. And I don't believe it was until early 1900s where they were allowed to move back in, or maybe it was the late 1890s. But it is it's a dark spot on our history of Minnesota.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Barry. Good to visit with
you
again.
Welcome.
Barry Babcock, a local historian, joins us from time to time to tell us about topics in Minnesota history.